Today's sutta is the Arana Vivanga Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya number 139. And although we did give you the word of the Buddha teachings to go through, which are very, very precious and but well worth looking at in your own time, Ajahn Brahm and I decided that we would be a little bit mix and match and just do the suttas that we really love and that really speak to us. And it might not be an obvious kind of sequence of sutta order, but somehow when we really relate to the suttas, then we can bring them to life. And so this is one that I often quote in my teachings, Dharma talks and sutta classes, but only in part. And so I thought it might be nice to have an in-depth look at this sutta today. So some of you are rubbing your hands in glee, which is a very good start. Nice to see that. And we have put the, or we will be putting the link to the sutta in the chat box. I'm using the Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. You might have another translation that you want to compare it with, or you might just want to listen with your heart. You don't have to read the words, you can just listen. And in fact, that's the way the Buddha taught. Thus have I heard was always the beginning of the sutta, because the Venerable Ananda would repeat these suttas after the Buddha's passing away and speak about them as what he had heard. So listening to the Dhamma enables us to practice the Dhamma while we receive the teachings of the Buddha. And I personally find that very powerful, especially when I'm on retreats. And personally for me, I prefer not to have kind of screens, you know, projectors and books in my hand, but just to take it in and to trust that whatever you need to pick up on, whatever is relevant for you, will soak in or be safe for another day. So we're not going to do it from an academic perspective, but more from a practice perspective. And I'll read through the summary, which the sutta begins with, and then we'll go into more detail throughout the sutta. So here we go, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of non-conflict. And really, what is non-conflict? The exposition on how to live at peace with others, with the world, and most importantly, within. So as I said, it begins with, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There, the Blessed One addressed the monastics, I'm making it more inclusive, or we could say the community, because there may well have been lay people there as well. The Blessed One addressed the monastics or community thus. Monastics, Venerable Sir, they replied. And the Blessed One said this. Monastics or community, I shall teach you an exposition of non-conflict. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the monastics replied. And the Blessed One said this. So this is a little summary. One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue self-mortification, which we prefer to translate as practices that tire out the body and mind. The Pali word is attakilamatana yoga. So atta is like oneself. Kilo is something that tires or wears you out. And anu yoga means literally being yoked to that practice. So kind of pursuing it and being bonded to that kind of practice, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way, discovered by the Tathagata is the Buddha, avoids both extremes, giving vision, giving knowledge. It leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So that's the first thing that leads to non-conflict. Secondly, one should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. And the next one, number three, one should know how to define pleasure. And knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. That is your green light to go for the pleasure that comes from within. And we'll go more into that later on. And the next one, number four, one should not utter covert speech and one should not utter overt, sharp speech. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. One should not insist on local language and one should not override normal usage. This is the summary of the exposition of non-conflict. So straight away from this summary, we can see two major points being pointed to that conduce to peace, that avoid conflict. And they're basically around happiness, pleasure, the real meaning of pleasure and the kind of pleasure we should pursue. And also speech, how we speak, how we teach the Dhamma, how we speak to one another, the way that we speak, the speed that we speak, and the kind of language that we use. So we're going to go into these in a lot more detail now, but I think probably in our own lives, we can see how this can be true, right? Because it's when we try to pursue the wrong kinds of pleasure that we get into trouble. We create conflict with other people. And also speech is something that is one of those things that can really harm and hurt us and that becomes difficult to overcome. So one should not pursue sensual pleasure. We're going into detail here. Which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And I have to point out, because Ajahn Brahm is sitting right next to me, that one of those words, the word coarse, is actually a translation of a word milha, which literally means something like urine. And you can imagine what the coarser word of that is. So one should not pursue... Okay, so the first one is one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue these practices. Here it says self-mortification, but let's think of it as practices that tire out the body and mind, which are painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? So... the first one, the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. So one point I'd like to make here is that this is not a value judgment. As much as the Buddha pointing out, as he always does, the things that lead to suffering and the things that lead to happiness. And this is the Buddha's only wish for us, that we come out of suffering and we gradually develop the happiness inside the mind. So we're not saying that pursuing sensual pleasures or enjoying some sensual pleasures is bad or evil or terrible and it makes you an awful person. We're just saying that it is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. And it's the wrong way because it's taking you away from the happiness in the mind. And of course, if we get addicted to these kind of pleasures, you know, and want more and more of them, then we are going to suffer and we are going to feel despair when they're taken away from us. And we can see this even with relationships. You know, if you're very attached to somebody, it may be quite a wholesome relationship, but still, if that's your main source of pleasure, if you haven't developed a happiness inside that's independent of the pleasures of the body and the mind, or sorry, the body and sensuality, then the parting when those relationships come to an end is going to be really difficult to bear. So we feed ourselves with these sensual pleasures. We're actually addicted to them. And that's again what this word anuyoga means. One who is yoked to these pleasures, whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, basically is on the wrong path. There's a kind of addictive quality there. And I don't know if you've noticed, but there's also a law of diminishing returns, the kind of pleasures that once really hit the spot for you, after a while no longer do. And I've seen this in my own life. I've seen it with, say, people that go on really extravagant holidays year after year. Maybe one year they go kind of on a little, B&B holiday. And then the next year they think, no, we need a nice hotel this year with a swimming pool and, you know, everything done for us. And then they get into going on cruises, on these massive cruise ships where you can literally eat anything you like at any time of day. You know, and it's not just the cruise around, you know, the cooler countries, but it's a cruise to the Mediterranean. And then it's a cruise to the Bahamas or something like that. And each year, you know, it has to be better than the last because these pleasures become really stale. You know, there really is no satisfaction there. Otherwise, you could just go on one cruise and that would be enough. Great. You don't need to bother with any more holidays ever again because your holiday has been so satisfying. So it's just pointing out that these things aren't satisfying in a sustained way. And we tend to need more and more of them just to feel happy and even eventually just to feel normal, just to feel a normal amount of well-being. So he goes on to say, disengagement from the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. So it's disengaging from this kind of pleasure that helps us to come upon the right way. So, of course, this begs the question of how we disengage. Do we just push these things away? Do we try and eat disgusting food because, you know, we shouldn't enjoy our food? And I was speaking to Ajahn Brahm at lunchtime today, and many people, when they enter monastic life, take that on as a kind of so-called spiritual practice and actually mix all their custard into their beef casserole or their lentil stew, you know, because they shouldn't be attached, or they just eat one pot of really disgusting stew and keep on adding to it day after day until they feel really, you know, put off by food. But actually what you notice you're doing when you practice these things is you're actually going to the second extreme, which is a kind of self-mortification or a practice that makes you sick, basically. The practice that wearies the body and mind because you're simply not enjoying your food. And I have an example of this myself because in Myanmar, when I was practicing there for the first 4 years of my monastic life, the food was really, really basic and actually not very tasty, let's put it that way. But of course, we felt immense gratitude for whatever was offered because we lived in such a poor village. And I was well aware that the people in the village ate much, much coarser, poorer quality food than we did. And they gave us their very, very best. So, you know, in the beginning, I was okay with the food. But after a while, I realized it didn't suit my body at all. And we also used to chant this little reflection before we ate, which went something like, I eat this food, which is disgusting in nature. Only for the maintenance of my body and the spiritual practice, only for the sake of the holy life, which is actually not the chant that's done in most Thai forest monasteries. There it's just to, you know, eat for the purpose of eating so that we can practice well. But here we actually said the food which is disgusting in nature. And that really, I think, over time made it very difficult to eat. And we were already eating probably far less, especially less protein, less flavors, less kind of digestive spices and herbs than I would normally have eaten. And my digestion became really, really bad. So it doesn't work to kind of try and cut off craving at the source, but at the level of the object. Yeah, we have to go inside and see where that craving's coming from and see if we can find a different way to satisfy what's a very human need for pleasure. Because we are driven as human beings by pleasure. And yet there's some kind of pleasure that leads towards peace, towards wisdom, and some kind of pleasures that, if pursued, lead away. So the important word here is to pursue. It doesn't mean that we can't enjoy nature. We can't enjoy even music as lay people. You know, music that's hopefully uplifting for the mind rather than kind of stimulating really difficult emotions or intense emotions. It's okay to enjoy some of these pleasures, but to actually pursue them is the problem here. Like, what are you actually directing your mind to? What are you making important in your life? This is the thing. So how do we disengage? And I think one of the first ways to disengage is to realize that these sensual pleasures are not satisfying, to actually lessen their importance in our life. Yesterday I was speaking to Ajahn Brahm and he was saying, experiment. What is it like to actually relax and to enjoy the pleasure of a relaxed body instead of the kind of stimulating pleasures of sensuality or delicious food? Sometimes it's much more enjoyable just to be outside, sitting under a tree, relaxing, just allowing all the aches and the pains of the body to settle down until the body starts to disappear. So take a rest, especially if you're tired. Take a break. Sit outside and watch the trees grow. You don't have to do the gardening while you're on retreat, even though we are doing a bit of gardening over here to keep our little trees alive, but only do what's enjoyable and calming for the senses rather than things that stimulate the senses and agitate the mind. Another way is to not own things. We can come out of this attachment towards sensuality by realizing that everything in our life is, in a sense, a gift. As a monastic, this is much easier because literally everything I look at is a gift. And I do my best to care for it. I've got all these beautiful plants and young trees in the monastery to plant outside eventually. And I feel like a kind of custodian of these things. So I care for them, I tend to them. But then the other day when we were traveling in London, many of them literally got burnt alive in the conservatory. There was a mini heat wave and the leaves turned brown, even on my little ginkgo tree that was flourishing with beautiful green leaves. And I did feel a little bit sad. And then I remembered that this is just part of life, right? I can care for this little tree. I can give it all the best possible conditions. But some things are out of my control. And it's a really sobering reminder of climate change, and this is the destruction that we as human beings have done to the world. So nothing is lasting, not even the beautiful nature around us. We really need to care. It's not a reason to say it doesn't matter, it's not important, but it is a recollection, a reflection to remind us that, things eventually go their own way. We can't keep these things forever. Another way to disengage from sensual pleasures is this beautiful practice of sense restraint, actually drawing our senses inward, especially on retreat. There are different ways to practice what is called Indriya Samvara. Is it Indriya Sam? Oh, I forget now. Samvara, Indriya Samvara Sila. Which literally means a kind of guarding of the senses or restraint of the senses. And one way is just to notice how we're using our senses. Are we using them in a way that stimulates things like lust and desire by only looking at the attractive aspects of a person or a particular, maybe new car or piece of clothing that you'd like? You only see the beauty in it. You don't see the cost. Or you don't see, for example, if it's a human being that you're having lustful feelings towards, you don't think about the fact that they have body odor, that their breath smells in the morning. You only see what you want to see and what feeds that desire. So to start disengaging from that, not pursuing that, is to look at the whole picture with a much more objective mind. So to see the beauty, but also to see the faults, the flaws, and not to get sucked in by those things that stimulate lust. So this is a really wonderful way of actually guarding the senses, noticing the kind of relationship you have with the objects of the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the way we also use thought to think about those things in our mind. And another way of guarding the senses is actually to allow the senses to quieten down. So I often call this like cooling the senses, actually having less sensory input altogether, so that you can start to tune up to the pleasures of the mind. And in a retreat situation like this, it's quite natural. You know, hopefully you're not having to run too many errands. You're not having to talk to too many people apart from, you know, basic sort of day-to-day things. And so you can really start to allow the senses to be quiet. In meditation, we close our eyes. So, you know, most of what we take as the world immediately disappears. You know, even the world of sound is much less compelling in many ways than the world of sight, much less stimulating. And then the sounds hopefully start to soften and disappear. If not, you can kind of let them fall off the corners of the mind. You can just keep them there in the background, but don't drag them in to the center of the mind. Don't make a thing of the sounds. There's a little story actually from one of Ajahn Brahm's monks. I think I know who it is. And he had his brother over to stay at Bodhinyana many years ago. And Ajahn Brahm said, "Do you think that's going to be okay? What if your brother snores?" And he said, "Yeah, maybe he will snore, but I'll be fine. You know, we'll just see how it goes." And of course, his brother came to stay in his hut and he started snoring really, really loudly. And this monk was used to only the sound of the trees, the wind in the trees and the kangaroos. And so the whole first night he was unable to sleep because of his brother's loud snores. But then the second night he realized he was going to, you know, have to change his attitude somehow to survive another sleepless night. And so what he did instead was try to go to sleep before his brother. But actually that didn't work either. And so his brother started snoring again. He thought, "Oh no, here we go again." But then he realized he could have this kind of sense restraint. He could try to look for something else in that snore other than the irritating qualities of it. And he started to imagine that it was this beautiful music kind of drifting in from the deva world. I don't know how kind of bumpy the snoring was. But he changed his whole perception of the snore and tried to kind of tune into it as something lovely, something soothing, something relaxing. And he managed to go to sleep. So we can do this in our mind. I remember one time that I was in Burma, and even as we were meditating in the hall, they were building the hall, literally above our heads. We were sitting in the front part, and the back part was being built because Goenkaji was arriving, my first meditation teacher, and we needed a much bigger space. And it wasn't like a normal roof that they were building, you know, just with kind of four corners. It had all these little wooden squares on the roof. This is the kind of style in Myanmar. It has small, small squares made of four pieces of wood all joined together like a kind of tapestry. So there were bang, 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 bang in every single corner of these squares while we were trying to meditate. And it was very helpful to me. I actually realized that the only way to really deal with the noise was to kind of get underneath it, to kind of go beneath the noise, to go deep inside. And so after a while, I could still hear it, but it really didn't bother me so much. You know, the inner world was much more obvious, much more enhanced than the world of sound outside. And I think that noise continued through most of the night as well. There were many sleepless nights living in Asia. Sometimes people had the lights on the whole night and they were just talking to each other while I was trying to sleep. Other times you could hear the building work. And I remember having this sense of learning to lie low. Literally learning to lie underneath the sounds, kind of somewhere out of reach. And of course, this was very helpful for the meditation. It's turning our attention away from the senses and into a quiet place inside. So this is a very beautiful way of disengaging. It's not saying, "I don't like this, I'm going to push this away." It's not kind of getting angry with it or trying to, you know, futilely go to a quieter place. Sometimes we're stuck in the middle of things and we can simply change our attitude and also turn in another direction. Yeah. This is similar to what's meant by nibbida, which is often translated as, how do they translate it? Sometimes disenchantment, sometimes repulsion or revulsion, which are much stronger words. But I kind of like the word turning away from the disturbance and towards the path of peace. So we can guard our senses and also use insight to see the sense world as defective and a burden. Our bada is an affliction, a burden to the mind. Seeing these things as basically taking us away from inner peace. So again, it's not a value judgment, but it's a use of wisdom to understand where our happiness really lies. So this is one way to disengage, or several ways to disengage from sensuality, from sensual pleasure. And the next one is the pursuit of self-mortification. Painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of, let's say, practices that tire or fatigue the body and mind is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, pain, despair, and fever, and is the right way. So the disengagement from that those practices is a state without suffering and is the right way. It's also interesting to me that it's saying which is the noble path and which is the ignoble path. So it's not leading you towards streamlining. It's not leading you towards full enlightenment. This is the thing. So disengaging from practices that tire the mind, and I had a think about this and came up with a few examples that we might not always kind of come to mind. And one of them is the kind of busyness of our lives. Isn't this a modern day kind of self-mortification? Isn't it a practice that tires and wearies the body and mind? You know, many of us have such busy lives, full-time jobs, and I don't know what you think about things like AI, but to me, it's just kind of a way to make us work even faster and get the results in even more quickly, you know, without even doing the work, just borrowing other people's work. Anyway, I won't talk about that because Bhante Sujata did his bit to kind of completely discredit AI while he was here. But our lives are basically full of all these things that promise us to save time. And actually all they do is make us work harder, faster, longer hours. We get stuck in traffic, you know, through the climate crisis, we get hotter weather, colder weather. And most of the time we're pretty much tired out. So this is one of the reasons that in the Metta Sutta, it says that one of the prerequisites for practicing Metta, for practicing the path of peace, is to actually simplify our lives, you know, to have simple lives that are unburdened, unbusy with duties, and just really focus on what matters. It doesn't mean we're not working hard. You know, I work really, really, really hard, but I try to declutter my life from useless tasks, from things I don't really have to do. And if I do slip into kind of scrolling on social media after I've already made my post, then I notice the next day I wake up feeling, you know, not as bright as I should. So the use of social media can be a practice that tires the mind, and also a practice of indulgence in sensual pleasure, right? You get so many images, so many kind of compelling things to read on social media. It's not only very stimulating, but it also tires the mind. Another thing is practices, psychological kind of dispositions that we have, such as pleasing other people, trying so hard to be perfect, trying so hard to please and be the way we think we should to be loved. Isn't this a practice that tires the mind? And that leads in the wrong direction. It leads away from peace. Sometimes, of course, these psychological patterns that we have are very entrenched, and this is where we need to do some preliminary work. Rather than just observe them endlessly in meditation, it might be helpful to have some counseling, you know, to really do some work around trauma. You know, there's so many different methods and therapies these days, and there should be no stigma in that. You know, to come at, help us come out of some very entrenched patterns that actually don't really lead in the direction of our peace, of our happiness and well-being. Living up to other people's expectations. Isn't it impossible? Because you don't even know what other people expect. And their expectations are changing all the time. even worse than that is trying to live up to our own expectations. Because we have to live with ourselves all the time. So can we lower those expectations so that, again, we have a simpler, more peaceful life? We can make mistakes. You know, we don't have to give a brilliant sutta class. We can just offer what comes to mind and not take ownership of it, not take responsibility for that. As long as our motivation is good, we do the best with what we have. You know, we put kindness into it, we put compassion into it, and we leave the results to nature. This is a much more beautiful way to live. A very obvious way that we tire our minds is trying to push through the exhaustion, or trying again to live up to people's expectations through force. You know, really just pushing ourselves so hard and being so self-critical. If somebody could see the way we speak to ourselves, they think, wow, if they speak like that to other people, they surely can't have any friends. Right? And you are someone's friend. So if you speak to yourself like that, you're speaking to someone else's friend in a really horrible way. Actually, one of my Anagarikas sometimes says, don't speak to my friend like that or my teacher like that. And that's a really nice wake-up call for me. So see if you can speak to yourself more beautifully, with more encouragement, giving yourself the benefit of the doubt. So we haven't even come to the really juicy bit yet, but we're only halfway through. How are you all going with this? Still engaged? You're not meant to disengage from the sutta class, but only disengage from sensuality and self-mortification. So we'll keep going on. So here we get to the beautiful middle way. And the middle way is what you know of as the Majjhima Patipada, the Eightfold Path. So here we go. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, avoids both these extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? It is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, or as Ajahn Brahm prefers, and I have to agree with this, right endeavor, right mindfulness, and right, do you know? Right stillness. So in this translation, it still says concentration, but one of the reasons I was drawn to Ajahn Brahm's teachings is because in Myanmar, where I was practicing for many years and for many hours every day, it just dawned on me one day that samadhi is not concentration. Samadhi is something actually very expansive, very soft, very spacious, and very, very still. And it's anything but tight and contracted and kind of screwed up in the mind. Yeah. You might have heard of people having, well, having samadhi headaches or getting headaches from meditation, you know, especially when they try to concentrate on the breath. And that's because they're going to the breath too soon, before the mind's really ready, before the mind is receptive enough to receive the subtle breath. So when we've actually done the preparation, which are the previous seven factors of this path, there's absolutely no need to concentrate. We've already put the first factors in place that give rise to being able to hold the breath in a really gentle and yet effective way, so that the breath stays with us. We don't have to grab it and kind of drag it in. So the Noble Eightfold Path is the middle way here. And one point I'd like to make is that the middle way is not between these two extremes. It's not that it's kind of sort of this bland place between sensuality and between pain. It's not a kind of neutral space where we don't really feel anything at all. It's actually a completely different direction. So I like to think of the two extremes, you know, of indulging in sense pleasures or indulging being yoked to the practices that tire the mind as movements that go out into the world of the senses, kind of off at tangents like this. You know, one goes this way, one goes the other. And actually, funnily enough, they tend to follow right one after the other as well. You know, you swing from one to the other. And it's not that the middle path is somewhere between the two. The middle path is going this way. It's going in. It's going away from the senses and taking you inside on an inner journey. And this will become clear later on in this sutta, that this path, the inner path, is a path full of happiness. It's just a different kind of happiness from the happiness of the senses. And certainly it's not achieved by exhausting the body and mind. So, taking a little break from that subject, we're now going into part of the sutta that talks about speech. So, this is the second type of way to avoid conflict. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? How, monastics, does there come to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma? When one says, and this is quotation marks, all those engaged in the pursuit of of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, which is low, etc., and unbeneficial, are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way. One thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, low, etc., and unbeneficial, are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification or practices that tire the body and mind, which are painfully noble and unbeneficial, are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of practices that tire the body and mind are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they've entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. Okay. So basically, what we're doing here is picking up the teachings in the wrong way. We've just heard how to practice, what is the right way, what is the wrong way, and now we make it personal. We start saying, oh, these people are doing it right, these people are doing it wrongly. And this is natural in a sense, but also misguided from people like most of us here who still see things in terms of a self. So I'll carry on. There's a lot more examples. When one says, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they've entered upon the wrong way, one thus disparages some. When one says, all those who've abandoned the fetter of being are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they've entered upon the right way, one thus extols some. This is how there comes to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma. So listen to the next part, and this is really beautiful language because it's using the language of non-self. It's using the language of process, cause and effect. So how, monastics, does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma? When one does not say, all those engaged in the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires have entered upon the wrong way, but instead says, the pursuit is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Then one teaches only the Dhamma. The other thing that comes to mind for me now is that this is stating something universal. It's stating a universal principle rather than pointing to people who do this or people who don't. So you don't have to feel ashamed. It's just that you haven't had the teachings yet. We haven't had enough of the teachings yet. In fact, it's our teacher's fault if we're doing this. So another example, when one does not say all those disengaged from the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires have entered upon the right way, but instead says, the disengagement is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. Then one teaches only the Dhamma. So does this make sense? I hope this makes sense. Do you want me to read through more of them? Yes. Okay, I'll keep reading. I want to get to the bit about pleasure, so I'm hoping we'll get there yet. Okay. When one does not say all those engaged in the pursuit of self-mortification have entered upon the wrong way, but says instead the pursuit is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those disengaged from the pursuit of practices that tire the body and mind have entered upon the right way, but says instead, the disengagement is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the wrong way, but says instead, as long as the fetter of being is unabandoned, being too is unabandoned. So much more powerful, isn't it? Then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those who have abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the right way, but says instead, when the fetter of being is abandoned, being also is abandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. So it was with reference to this that it was said, one should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage, and knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. So how often do we extol or disparage ourselves? How often do you hear this kind of speak inside your own mind? I should not have done this. I did this which caused me suffering. How about instead? Being pulled towards sensual pleasures is a state that causes suffering. And just learning from what we're doing in our mind. We can try to change our language, change the way we speak, and look at our practice in terms of understanding cause and effect, understanding the principles of Dhamma, what leads to suffering, what leads to peace, what leads to a release from suffering, a release from fever, vexation, despair. So just notice when that language of I or them or other is coming in, and see if you can change it into something much more universal, because really what we're observing in our mind is what's happening for everybody. It's the same process, you know, the Eightfold Path is the Eightfold Path for all. No one's excluded from that. So here's my favorite part of the sutta now. Here we go. So this is principle number 3. One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Monastics or community. There are these 5 chords of sensual pleasure. What 5? Forms cognizable by the eye. Sounds cognizable by the ear. Odors cognizable by the nose. Flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the 5 chords of sensual pleasure. Now, the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these 5 chords of sensual pleasure are called sensual pleasure. Here we go. I think this is the place, actually, that the word milhasukha is used. A filthy pleasure. Ajahn Brahm likes to use the word P-I-double-S, happiness. A filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, that it should not be developed, that it should not be cultivated, and that it should be feared. I also want to make one more translation. One of these is Hina Gammo, I think, is there as well. And Gammo literally means, I think that's the translation, for, they're translating that as coarse here, but it literally means of the village, like of the common person. So the pleasures that are just your ordinary pleasures, the things everybody does, you know, maybe going down to the pub or watching a movie or obviously having sex, etc. These are just things of the common folk. They're not actually things of the noble people. Or it's not taking you on the noble path, let's say. So it should not be pursued, developed, cultivated. And it should be feared. So the word fear is a funny one for us, I think, in English, because it sort of seems to smack of, you know, feeling guilty or a kind of a type of Christian fear, maybe if we're born in Christian kind of countries or cultures. But I think really what it's saying is that there's a consequence to this, you know, so we should treat them with apprehension, knowing the risk, knowing the danger. And there is a fear, there is a danger in pursuing these things to the exclusion of pursuing happiness within ourselves. As I said, a little bit of sensual pleasure is just normal and a natural part of life, but it's the pursuit of these things that's the problem. So now he goes into another kind of happiness. So here, monastics or community, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. This is called the bliss of renunciation, nekamasukha, the bliss of seclusion, pavivekasukha, the bliss of peace, upasamasukha, and the bliss of enlightenment, sambodhisukha. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and it should not be feared. So as again, this is your green light for welcoming the pleasure that arises through meditation. When it's secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states. And actually, even deeper than that, the real translation should really be secluded not only from the sensual pleasure, which is kamasukha in Pali, but secluded from the five senses themselves, which is karma. I think the Pali here is viviceha kamehi, vivicha akusalehi dhammehi. So vivicha kamehi means like separated from the sensual world, from the sensory world. So sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch start to fade. And that's what Ajahn Brahm's talking about, or what we're talking about when we say the body starts to disappear into the background. First, it might start to become very light, almost a feeling like it's just tingling or it's floating or it's very kind of ephemeral. And then eventually it starts to fade as the mind takes over, the mind becomes empowered. And sounds also start to get further and further away. And in the first jhana, they already end. You're already secluded from sound, even in the first jhana. And it's just that the sound can bring you out. You know, if there is a very loud sound, usually in the first jhana, unless you've been practicing for a very long time, it might be a little bit fragile and it can bring you out again. In the second jhana, even sound doesn't penetrate, I think. So this is praised by the Buddha as the bliss of renunciation, seclusion, peace, and enlightenment, because it's taking you closer and closer towards enlightenment and giving you an opportunity, because the five hindrances and the five senses are abandoned here. Most of the five hindrances operate in relation to the sensual world, right? If you think about what you're craving, it's something sensual. It's sights, sounds, smells, tastes, or touches usually. Sometimes it might be jhanas. And that's not a very skillful way to practice. But actually pursuing, you know, the practice of meditation is not in itself a bad thing. In fact, it should be followed. It should be cultivated in our practice. So how do we pursue happiness? How do we pursue deep meditation? And I think this links back to the first part of the sutta, you know, by practicing the Eightfold Noble Path. This is how we pursue pleasure. And that pursuit of pleasure starts with sila, most often for most of us. It might start with hearing the Dhamma, you know, a little bit of right view just to get you going. And of course, that right view should inform our attitudes in life. If we understand that people suffer, we ourselves suffer, then surely we don't want to be cruel. Surely it makes more sense to have compassion, to be really gentle, to have loving kindness for all beings, even those who cause a great deal of harm for others. You know, they're suffering, and we know this through our practice. When we're happy, when we're practicing well, when we feel peaceful, we can't harm another person. We don't even have a trace of harm in us. You know, when you see really wonderful people, they, of course, may intentionally harm others, but certainly not through any kind of ill will. And they're usually willing to admit their mistakes, to apologize, to ask forgiveness. We can't go through our life without harming anyone at all. Even the Buddha couldn't do that. You know, he did upset people. He had enemies. His own cousin turned against him. Of course, not for any good reason, but still, as long as we're alive, we'll cause some harm. But our intention becomes pure. And we start to get happiness from the practice of precepts, from the practice of virtue. It's much more than just the five or the eight precepts. It's really starting to use our body, speech, and mind in ways that really brings benefit for others in any way we can. This includes speaking beautiful, kind, uplifting words, not only to others, but also to ourselves. So how else do we pursue happiness? I would say one way to so-called pursue it in our meditation is just to notice it's there and to start valuing the happiness, no matter how subtle it might seem, valuing that little bit of peace that's starting to grow in your mind and not just throwing it away. Not just saying, well, that's nothing, you know, now I need to boil the kettle, make my lunch. It's like, no, you're a little bit quieter than when you began. So stay centered in that peace. Keep that in the front of your mind and try to infuse whatever you do with peacefulness, with calm. Use every single activity in your life to deepen the Eightfold Path. You know, if you see joy coming, somebody mentioned yesterday that when they start to see lights arise in the mind, which are certainly full of happiness and full of peace, they have this feeling like grasping it, you know, they want to go and snatch it and bring it in. And the simile came to mind of like walking down the street and seeing a friend on the opposite side of the road, or maybe you're sitting in a cafe, you see them outside and you go and grab them, you know, maybe by the hand, maybe by the throat, and you say, come to the cafe, I want to sit with you. What's that person going to do? They're going to think, my goodness, this is a crazy person. I don't want to go and have a cup of tea with them. So instead of that, you just cross the road kindly and gently, and you just be with that person. You give them value. You give them importance. You give them your company, first of all. And then you can gently invite them to come and join you in the cafe. So in a similar way, you know, we give these nimittas, we give the bliss, the peace that starts to arise in the mind, even that little bit of silence, we give it some company, some gentle, loving, friendly, and respectful company, right? It's not yours to grab onto. It's not yours to make stay. And then we gently invite it inside. So this is one way that we pursue and cultivate the pleasure, just by noticing it and by giving it importance and also treating it with a great deal of respect. So it was with reference to this that it was said, one should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So I've not gone deep into the pleasures of deep meditation because that will come later, but let's see if we can, I don't think we will finish reading this actually, but I'll read a little bit more about speech. So we're kind of circling between the speech and the pleasure in this sutta. So here we go. This is the fourth principle. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt sharp speech. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Here, monastics, when one knows covert speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, still unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. But when one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. Here, monastics, or community, when one knows overt sharp speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows overt sharp speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. But when one knows overt sharp speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. So that's when it's sharp. So it's okay to use sharp speech, but you have to know the right time. And the right time is usually not when another person is feeling fragile or tired or, you know, exhausted. It's not when they're having depression or something like that. It's usually when you've asked permission, when you have a mind of loving kindness. Ideally, you would speak gently, but here it's talking about sharp speech and saying there is a place for that occasionally, and it should be for the person's benefit as well. One should speak unhurriedly and not hurriedly. So even though we only have 3 minutes left, I will speak unhurriedly. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? Here, community, when one speaks hurriedly, one's body grows tired and one's mind becomes excited. One's voice is strained and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly, is indistinct and hard to understand. Here, when one speaks unhurriedly, one's body does not grow tired, nor does one's mind become excited. One's voice is not strained, nor does one's throat become hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is distinct and easy to understand. Okay. I don't know if I should keep going or what do you think? Would you like me to run over time by 5-10 minutes and finish the sutta? I'm only seeing one response, but now I'm seeing quite a lot of responses. Okay, so here we go. And if you do have to leave for any reason, please feel free. So I'll just read through the last part. One should insist on local language and one should not override normal usage. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? How, monastics, does there come to be insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage? Here, people in different localities. Oh, sorry. Here, in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a bowl, a vessel, a saucer, a pan, a pot, or a basin. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, one speaks accordingly, firmly adhering to that expression and insisting only this is correct, anything else is wrong. This is how there comes to be insistence on local language and overriding normal usage. And how does there come to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage? Here, in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, etc., or a basin. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, without adhering to that expression, one speaks accordingly, thinking, these venerable ones, it seems, are speaking with reference to this. This is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage. In other words, you're cooperative and respectful, easy to get along with. Here, the pursuit of enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, low and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Aha, I think this is now the summary of the sutta. Here, monastics, disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire, which is low, etc., etc., and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, the pursuit of practices that tire and weary the body and mind, which are painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monastics, disengagement from the pursuit of self-mortification or practices that tire the body and mind, which are painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monastics, the middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both these extremes, giving vision, giving knowledge. It leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, and to Nibbana. There's one thing here, the difference between knowledge and direct knowledge means that knowledge becomes your own through experience. It is a state without suffering, and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monastics, extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma is a state beset by suffering and is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, not extolling or disparaging and teaching only the Dhamma is a state without suffering and it is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, monastics, sensual pleasure, a filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure is a state beset by suffering, etc., and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. Here, monastics, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment is a state without suffering, and is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. Here, covert speech that's untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, and therefore is a state with conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, therefore is a state without conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without suffering, therefore a state without conflict. Overt sharp speech that is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, therefore a state with conflict. Overt sharp speech that is true, correct, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, therefore is a state with conflict. Overt sharp speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without suffering, therefore it is a state without conflict. The speech of one who speaks hurriedly is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, therefore a state with conflict. Here, the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is a state without suffering, therefore this is a state without conflict. Insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage is a state beset by suffering, therefore, a state with conflict. Non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. Therefore, a state without conflict. Therefore, monastics or practitioners, you should train yourselves thus. We shall know the state with conflict, and we shall know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. Now, bhikkhus or monastics, Subhuti is a clansman who's entered upon the way without conflict. So this is an example of someone who's done that. This is what the Buddha said. The monastics and community were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Are you delighted in the Blessed One's words? Fantastic. So just to summarize, or make one more small point, is again this link between conflict and suffering and non-conflict and non-suffering, the two concerns of the Buddha, suffering and the end of suffering. So this is what all the teachings in the suttas are related to, roll around suffering and the way out. None of this is a judgment. That's why we don't disparage or extol. And the path out of suffering is a path of ever-increasing happiness. So it's a happiness of the middle way. It's the happiness of the Noble Eightfold Path, culminating in jhanas, the happiness of peace, seclusion, renunciation of sensuality, of ill will, of self-mortification as well, and the bliss of enlightenment itself. So there you go. May this be of benefit to you. Very good. So, I was a little bit nervous because Ajahn Brown's right here. Teaching with my teacher present. So any faults are Ajahn Brahm's fault. And anything that I did well is also Ajahn Brahm's fault. Sure. No, it's also your fault. Right? Exactly. And it's all the Buddha's fault.
And you can't disparage me.
I can't disparage you, that's true. In fact, that was wrong, wasn't it, to say it's anyone's fault. So if anything went well, that was due to cause and effect, and the same if it didn't. So please take that principle to heart and don't disparage yourself. Okay, so we will meet back here at 6:30. You're welcome to stay logged in, and that will make it easy for our co-hosts. You don't have to. It's okay. We'll let you back in at 6:20 if you need to log off. So see you later.